that is in the Gospel according to Matthew. Introduction to lesson number 3, covering chapters 5, 6, and 7. The principles of the kingdom. There would appear to be two opposing kingdoms in this world, the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of heaven. And somewhere within these two kingdoms, each person has a place. During the time of the Lord's sojourn on this earth, there was a spirit of expectation and excitement among the Jews because they were tired of the political oppression of Rome. However, their conception of the coming kingdom of Messiah was purely a political one, and centered in the idea of the overthrow of the Roman power and the re-establishment of national Israel in the land with liberty to control their own affairs. Since the Lord Jesus Christ knew all men and knew what was in man, it was therefore necessary for him to disillusion his chosen followers by placing before them the true principles of his kingdom and the true character of the people who would be its citizens. There has been much confusion and controversy among different schools of interpretation regarding the teaching and application of the Sermon on the Mount. If we are clear in our thinking as to what the sermon is not, then perhaps we may be able to grasp what it is. First of all, it is not the law of God as given to the nation of Israel, for that law was given through Moses. Neither is it the teaching of that law which had been corrupted by the traditions of the Pharisees. Then it is certainly not the standard for church government, because the church was not in existence when this sermon was delivered. It is certainly not teaching the way of salvation for sinners, although many a gospel message has been preached from statements found in this sermon and taken out of context. In the first two verses of chapter 5, it seems obvious that Christ was addressing his disciples, while the multitude of people may have been thronging around and listening to his teaching. Now, with our thoughts centered on the King, and understanding that he is addressing himself to his chosen disciples, we are ready to listen to the royal proclamation, wherein the King sets forth the standards and principles upon which his kingdom will be built, and the character of the people who will be acknowledged as the citizens. This also will involve a new concept, and demonstrate that the kingdom will be spiritual and not national. Man's conception of a kingdom was material possessions, military power, and pageantry blended with political supremacy. The Lord's teaching is directed to the spiritual and moral character and gives the true meaning to what is meant by fruit that is answerable to repentance. The sermon proves that what we are is more important than what we have. Since we have considered the sermon in a general sense, it will now be helpful to consider each chapter separately. Chapter 5 may be studied as follows. First, take verses 3 through 16 and note the threefold relationship of the citizen of the kingdom. This new man is presented in relationship to God, then secondly to man, and thirdly to the world. It seems clear that in verses 3 through 12, in what is commonly called the Beatitudes, we are not viewing the outward circumstances, but rather the inward condition of the happy man, which would teach us that character is supreme. This cannot be a man according to the course of nature or a man living in sin. But rather is it the man who in truth is identified with Christ and has been renewed by the Spirit which descended and abode on Christ as recorded in chapter 3. The teaching then of the Beatitudes would be that the basis for the new plan is the new man. It is possible that the Lord was teaching his disciples that these principles must first be put into effect by his followers before that they could be administrators with him in his kingdom. This new man in relation to God begins by being poor in spirit, but finishes by hungering after righteousness and being filled. In relation to man, he begins by showing mercy and finishes by being a peacemaker and recognized as a member of God's family. In relation to the world, he is persecuted, but finds himself in the best of company with the prophets and assured of his reward. Now in verses 13 through 16, there is set forth the influence of the character of this new man: salt to prevent corruption and light to dispel the darkness. His influence will be known in the world in a public manner and in the house in a private manner. Verses 17 through 20 set forth the relation of the king and his subjects to the law. By his perfect obedience, Christ magnified the law and made it honorable. By his death, he met all its claims, and so became the end of the law for righteousness to all who believe. By his Spirit, he enables the believer to fulfill the righteous requirements of the law. From verse 21 to the end of the chapter, take note of the recurring statement, "I say unto you." Here the great king supersedes all that has ever been said, and speaks with absolute authority regarding the sacredness of life. While the hand may commit murder, he shows that it is the heart that conceives the act, and therefore the heart must be guarded. There is also a sacredness in the manner in which life is procreated, and he gives the law against adultery. There is also a sacredness that binds a man and his wife in the marriage union, and the Lord gives a law against divorce. Then dealing with the act of perjury, he teaches that it is best not to swear under any circumstances, but let your answers be yea or nay. The closing verses of this chapter deal with the law of non-resistance and the law of love, which culminates in the expression of the true character of the genuine child of God. In chapter 6, the Lord deals with the important things which are vital in life and teaches that righteous acts must be governed by pure motives, that religious acting to be seen by men is unworthy and unbecoming for the true citizen of the kingdom. The righteous act of giving must be done without ostentation, and God alone must be the judge and the rewarder of such deeds. Then he deals with the righteous act of praying. In prayer there must be purity of purpose according to the Lord's teaching. Prayer should be engaged in under strict privacy, in the secret place with the shut door. The sacred utterance can be presented to your Father. There is a certain philosophy in prayer. We should understand that in praying we are not endeavoring to persuade God to act against his will, nor are we seeking to inform God as if he didn't know. But in praying we are honoring him by bringing our wills into subjection to his will and acknowledging him as the giver of every good and perfect gift. Then he gives a pattern for prayer in which the true suppliant is seen in an established relationship as a child to a father. Then reverence is expressed for the name of God, and his rule is expected. Recognition for that rule is to be extended to earth as it is in heaven. The suppliant acknowledges his daily needs or requirements as coming from God his Father. He desires rectitude of state that will be well-pleasing to his Father, and true righteousness is anticipated with deliverance from the evil one. Then he deals with fasting. And this connection, let me quote from a great scholar who said, Fasting is one of those things in which the body shows its sympathy with what the spirit is passing through. This also is something that must be done secretly and not to impress men. It should be the result of a consciousness that the thing we seek from God is of greater importance than the gratification of natural desires. The remainder of this chapter deals with the right and wrong attitudes, God's possessions in this life, and the cares of this life. What is the good of having your heart centered on a whole supply of clothes that you don't wear, and the moths destroy these garments, on having large possessions of metal treasures for display, and the rust destroys them, or the thieves may break through and steal, and the things you set your heart upon are lost? Far better to set your heart upon things above, and lay up treasure there. Make your deposits in the bank of heaven, where the capital is secure and the interest guaranteed, and you will then have a single eye and be able to give undivided service to your true master. Regarding the necessities of life, there is no need to be over-anxious, because such an attitude is unnecessary, since your Father knoweth what things ye are in need of. It is also unworthy and displays a lack of trust or confidence in your Father. It is also unfruitful. Anxiety never produced anything for our good. In chapter 7, the great teacher deals with discipline, decision, discernment, and danger. In verses 1 through 5, there is discipline in relation to other people. The reason for this discipline is very obvious, and that is, we are not in the position of being able to judge motives, and so the final judgment must rest with God and not with us, and I must not presume to be able to give the final verdict. The reasonableness for this discipline is also plain. If I have a large beam in my own eye, how can I possibly see to remove the little splinter from my brother's eye? Then note the result of this discipline. If I will discipline myself to the point where I have clear vision and a single eye, I will then be able to assist my brother who is in need of my help. Verse 6 deals with discipline in relation to principles. It is necessary to have discretion with regard to holy things and holy people. Those who are not the children of the kingdom will show no appreciation for the things of the kingdom. Therefore, we must discipline ourselves to appreciate that which is holy, and not cast such things in the street to dogs or into the swine trough. Then in verses 7 through 12, it is discipline in relation to power. The child of the kingdom will require power to live. So three things are impressed upon us. Ask, seek, and knock. Ask would suggest the spirit of dependency, and this must always be the true spirit of the citizen in the kingdom. Then seek would suggest the spirit of urgency, and we must realize that time is precious and short, and so we seek with all diligence. Then to knock suggests the spirit of persistency. Verses 13 and 14 deal with two gates, two ways, and two destinies. And it should be noted that these verses are dealing with decision. The sermon appears to be at an end so far as the main teaching is concerned, but there must be the application of the truth and the corresponding responsibility of the hearers. Two gates, two ways, two paths for all, and all therein must go. Each soul on earth is making choice for life or endless woe. Then the teacher applies the test, which enables us to discern the true from the false, and thus be able to determine when a prophet is true or false, not by the label he wears, but by the fruit he bears. Then the great teacher concludes with a warning regarding a solemn danger, the danger of making a loud profession with the lips, but being void of the true life in the heart, being able to repeat many pious words, and yet being a worker of iniquity. The testing time will come, and what a man builds will either stand or the test or collapse. Not because of how it looks in the eyes of men, but according to the foundation on which it is built,
And thus ended the teaching of the principles of the kingdom by the great king, and the people were astonished at his doctrine.